In many therapeutic encounters with Orthodox gays and lesbians, my orthodoxy did serve a positive therapeutic function. My attempt to create a safe and supportive holding environment was facilitated by my being from an Orthodox authority figure who accepted and valued their perspective, tolerated their different selves, and validated their realities. In doing this work, there's been a parallel process of my own professional coming out. Until my involvement in this issue, my professional persona as a clinician and my personal role as an Orthodox Jew and wife of a rabbi were maintained with minimal overlap. In other words, I never usually let people know about my orthodoxy when I'm working, and people didn't know, you know, that my husband was a rabbi. I kept those kind of worlds separate. In my practice, I did treat many from the Orthodox community, but in the interest of therapeutic neutrality and professionalism, these worlds were separate and compartmentalized. As a clinician, coming out for me in the Orthodox community as a gay affirmative therapist was frightening at first. In other words, the fact that I was working with this community and not suggesting change or reparative therapy was frightening at first, not only because of the potential communal reactions, but also because of the experience of self-disclosure of any sort ran counter to any of my clinical training and expertise and experience. The courage of those who have faced these conflicts, but in working with these people and being involved in the film Trembling, I began to also move into the role of a little bit like as advocate, not of advocate of gayness, but of in the film, just educating the community about all the dimensions to this question. And I don't have a position about I'm not affirming, encouraging people to become gay, God forbid. But in fact, as every gay Orthodox person that I know, if you were to offer them to push a button and be straight, they would do that in a minute. And you know, I have no illusions about the ease of this life. It's not an easy life for these people. If it was up to me, if I can make them all straight, I would. But we can't. So in light of, since we can't, in being involved in the film Trembling, I have become more involved in educating the rabbis and educating the community about the dimensions of this problem. Now there are networks that, I don't know if I need to go into that, but there are a lot of support systems that are available for gay people, specifically from the internet. But I just want to close with one story. A very prominent Orthodox rabbi who had come to one of our, New York, who had come to one of the screenings of the film Trembling Before God, came up to us afterwards, and he said, next Yom Kippur, when I daven Al Chait, he said, because I'm going to clap especially hard at the part on Yatzanura, that we've given bad advice. He said, I realize all these years, that he hasn't really understood this question, and none of us have really, because the issue of gayness has been so secret, and it's been such a taboo subject, that none of us have really known much about this question. But now that people are coming out more, there's beginning to be more of an understanding about it. So he said he's going to clap especially hard on Yatzanura, realizing that we need to kind of, he said, to tshuva on the bad advice that we've given. But I think that we're all kind of in a state of kind of beginning to understand this question and beginning to deal with the implications of it for us as halachic Jews. So I don't propose any answers. I think it's more interesting to kind of raise the questions. And for me, I've come to be more comfortable kind of sitting in the state of not knowing and kind of living with that kind of tension, which for me is still there. Thank you, Sue. I'm sorry? I think what he meant was that when people came to him, trying to encourage people to kind of, bury these feelings and try to marry heterosexually. I think that's what he meant. Thank you. I'll repeat the question. Yeah. She's going to come to the mic.
I'm trying to formulate a question. My practice involves seeing from couples. I often encounter the secret world of the one spouse, particularly the male, who indulges in the world of solicitations and, as you mentioned in your story, prostitution. And I find it difficult to conciliate the two. As a therapist, I know you touched on it. Yes. Yes. Or outlet, or I'm experiencing the internet is becoming very prevalent. You know, I can go on the internet to satisfy myself, and it's not an affair. This was what was said to me last week. It's not an affair in the relationship, and the wife must tolerate this. I mean, I'm experiencing discomfort at that. And I do believe it was around orientation, sexual orientation. I'm struggling with that.
You all hear the question? You all have the question? I mean, the internet has posed interesting challenges, you know, for everybody, because I think what's hard about what happens on the internet is that in the comfort of one's own home at 3 a.m. when somebody's disinhibited and they're tired and they're you know, they get up out of bed and they start browsing the internet, all it takes is for them to, you know, to flick a finger, and all of a sudden, you know, a lot of their impulses are there to be had, you know, and this happens. And there have been more instances of even like with pedophilia, and which is not a gay issue at all. I mean, it's a heterosexual issue much more than a gay one, but you know, of people attempting to satisfy, you know, dark impulses of theirs, it's much easier with the internet. You know? Whereas before, somebody would have to kind of, you know, leave the house, go to an area where this is done, and seek something out in person. Now it's all of a sudden it's there to be had on the internet. So it's much more complicated, and I think it does kind of overstimulate, you know, many people who would do better not having that opportunity. So it is an issue. I think the acting out has different meaning for different people. It's hard to say, you know, across the board about what meaning it has. Is that what you're asking? I think it's a complex question. I think it's hard to say equivocally this is what it means for them. But it's certainly a tension that arises in among couples, and it's written about all the time now in family therapy journals. There's a lot written about this now, about the role of pornography and the role of internet acting out on couples, and what people, like you said, that people don't experience that as being unfaithful because they feel they're not doing anything; they're just kind of exploring on the internet. But of course, for the spouse, it feels very different. Right. And in fact, I think it does have a different meaning. I mean, it is, you know, it can be very destructive. What do they do? Good question. That's a good question. Did you all hear the question? What does the conversion therapy consist of? Okay. That's a good question. The father of this movement is Joseph Nicolosi. There's also a Jewish group called Jonah, which is a big proponent of change therapy. And it's interesting. In my practice, I've seen men, young men, who come to me, and they go to Jonah at the same time sometimes. They're kind of trying to cover themselves at both ends. And when they report to me what goes on in Jonah, one of their things, Jonah's theory is, they have, and this is Nicolosi's theory as well, how they understand gayness is that what they say is the construct is that there's been a weak father and a strong mother, and that there's the homosexual impulses are a function of the longing for the father, for the weak father. And that so according to Nicolosi and according to Jonah, these men need, you know, they're seeking male strength. And that they're mistaken, and that they seek it in a neurotic context. So part of the therapy that they offer is male bonding. So one of the activities that they do is they have like male activities where they go like competitive sports like basketball and bowling and interactive or football, and they try to, you know, encourage these men to engage in these activities in the hope that the contact or the male competitive feelings and strengthening their athletics and strengthening their like kind of traditionally macho kind of behaviors will appease their need for male contact, and then will then allow them to function heterosexually. And that's not been, I mean, according to anyone I've seen, that's never worked. And you know, as some of you may know, Rabbi Steve Greenberg, who was in the movie Trembling Before God, and he wrote an article. He says Musmach from YU, and he's continuing. He's still Orthodox. I mean, he describes himself as Orthodox. And he wrote a book called Wrestling God and Man about this question. And he, you know, if any of you know him, he's the most athletic, you know, seemingly, you know, macho type, if you're going to be stereotypic about it. But so this idea of Jonah, this construct of the male, the weak father, and the and the strong mother doesn't really hold. The other destructive aspect of that is that for the poor parents who are dealing with a child coming out, it also adds the whole layer of guilt on the parents. The parents feel like, where did I fail? What did I do wrong? And it's a tremendous pain for the parents, and heartbreaking because, like all of us know, I have children. All of us have dreams and aspirations and hopes for our children. And when some of those dreams and aspirations don't come true or don't come to fruition, there is a mourning process. And so with parents whose kids come out as gay, it really is like a loss. It's a tremendous loss. It's the loss of all those dreams and the fear that they're not going to have grandchildren, although gay people are beginning to have children, but Orthodox gays are trying to build families. But still, the traditional dream of what they expected is not going to happen in the way that they thought. And there's a huge loss and mourning that accompanies it. But what's hard in the construct of Jonah and the conversion therapy people is that they kind of blame the parents. Which is heartbreaking to see the parents have to struggle with that layer as well of the guilt of what they did wrong. But the other part of the therapy that they do is basically they talk about the family dynamics and they try to reconstitute what went wrong in the family. That's basically what they do. Some people do. No, there is that. There is that. In fact, my husband's a psychologist. He told me that when he was training at Washington University in psychology, there was a study being done on, there was shock treatments being done on what they did is they had, they took pictures of let's say they asked a gay man, let's say, who wanted to change. They would give him like 10 pictures of women. Naked women and 10 pictures of naked men, and they would have to rate them in order of attractiveness to them, and then they would, every time they would look at a picture of the most attractive woman, they would give him a positive some kind of positive stimulation, and every time he looked at the least attractive gay man, he would give him positive stimulation, and then they would increase it, and hopefully that was the hope that they would change people that way, but I'm not sure that it's been effective long term. Good question. Thank you. I'm glad you asked that because I wanted to clarify that. Thank you. The whole issue of sexuality in general is so huge and so confusing, and there's so little that's known about it, really. So there is a continuum, and it's important to think about that because not everybody who has homosexual erotic fantasies is gay, and there is the idea, and although that the people do go through different phases in their life where there are some people who do change over time in one direction or another. The only thing I would want to emphasize is that it's true that people do change over time. People go through different phases, but there's never been any studied way of making that happen. In other words, how that happens is very kind of mysterious, and there's no scientific way that's been documented and provable that this is the formula to make that happen. But you're right that there are definitely people who've gone through experiences in yeshiva or experiences in seminary, and then they move on to lead normal heterosexual lives. So as Kinsey wrote in the 1950s, which is very prophetic, there is a scale of sexuality, and people fall at different points in the scale. There are people who are, some people who are like 90-10, 90% gay and 10% heterosexual. Some people who are 50-50. Some people who are 30-40. It ranges. And so people who are able to put their homosexual feelings in a box and move on and be forge a heterosexual relationship, call it kavod. And I would argue though that, and so there is a continuum, and it's not a black and white. And sexuality does change over time, even more so I would think with lesbians than with gay men. I think women do. In my practice, I've seen lots of lesbian women who were married heterosexually and happily until the divorce, until things fell apart for other reasons, and then who opt for lesbian relationships. And it's hard to know exactly what does that mean. It is confusing. I think for gay men, it tends to be a little bit more complicated. I think one thing I'd want to emphasize though is that for in my experience at least, within the Orthodox community, that Orthodox people who are really committed to Frumkeit and committed to Yiddishkeit, if at all possible, they'd want to be straight. You know, because who wouldn't want to have a marriage and a family and be conventionally accepted? And most people, so if at all possible, they'd want to be straight. So the people that come out that they can't be, generally really have, for them, they really can't. There's nothing else that they can do, for the most part. You know, but again, there are people who have had experiences in seminary and are able to let them go, or who experience this in different parts of their times in their life and then move on and are able to forge heterosexual relationships. So it is complicated. Did that answer what you? Is that what you? Yeah, and that's just beginning to happen. The question was about firm gay couples who are beginning to have kids and live in the community, right? That's just beginning to happen. In fact, it's a couple. I mean, I consulted with a couple in the Midwest who is a lesbian couple, and they had a daughter, and she's now school age, and they're trying to get her into a day school. And then the day schools are struggling with what to do about these questions. But what does that mean for the community? All of those kind of questions. These are hard questions, but there are more and more gay Orthodox families that are being created. I know in Israel, there are several communities, several mono-Orthodox communities led by very prominent rabbis, where there are gay families living together. For example, it's a divorced mom with kids, who then is partnered with a woman, and the rabbi of the community promised her protection, that he would be on her side, he would help advocate for her, he would do it, get her kids into all the schools, as long as she was discreet. So there are, and I know in New York there are several gay couples who are getting married, you know, or just living together and forging a life, and they're Shomer Shabbos kosher from, you know, and they're joining shuls and beginning to, it's all beginning to happen, but it's in the past few years. You know, when the movie *Trembling Before God* came out, it really did create kind of an opening for a lot of these people to begin to say that they wanted to live in the community, they wanted to be visible, they wanted to be who they were and still be from. So it's beginning to happen, and you know, either through adoption or through artificial insemination. There are all sorts of, you know, now fertility is very complicated, and there are lots of ways that people are trying to get around the obstacles. And I think the challenge is going to be, you know, how do Orthodox communities, you know, allow them to be or not? That's going to be a challenge, especially in the day school issue. And that bridge hasn't been crossed yet, but it's beginning to be. Yeah. But there's a network of, and also the internet has provided a source of support for a lot of these people who are trying to write new scripts for these kind of lives. Yeah, everyone hear the question? How is it different from a young or adolescent female for an adolescent male? I mean, I think in general, you know, there's much more of a phobia towards homosexual behavior among men than there is among women. I mean, even among heterosexuals, you know, women are much freer about expressions of affection and kissing each other and hugging each other. You know, that's part of women's culture, whereas in male culture, you know, that's much more difficult, you know, because of the pressures that men feel to you know, assert their masculine identity. So I think there is also, I think that gayness is much more frightening, you know, for some reason among men than it is among women. So I think there's much more of a stigma for, you know, like even in my kids go to, you know, day schools and they report home, like, you know, if a boy wears a pink shirt, other boys will call him, you know, derogatory names for having worn a pink shirt, you know, those kind of things. And, you know, the biggest insult that you can give a kid in the playground is call them, you know, faggot, these awful names, you know. And that doesn't really happen so much among girls in the same way. So I think it's a little bit easier. My sense is that it's a little bit easier for lesbians in the firm community than it is for men. Also, they can kind of go undercover a little bit more, but that's my sense. But I mean, it's a struggle for both. I mean, I don't mean to diminish the struggle for Orthodox lesbians, but I think it's a little bit easier for women than it is for men. Mm-hmm. I think among, well, it, when I spoke to like Rebbetzins in seminaries in Israel, almost all of them described that they all of them acknowledged that they knew that this kind of behavior was happening in the dormitories, but they kind of dismissed it as being, this is just a phase, this is just, you know, this is partly because they're lonely, they're away from home. It was kind of explained more. I think when it happens in male yeshivas, it's a little bit taken a little bit more, it's a little bit more, I think people worry about it a little bit more. I think that's, it's reflective of, this, of the secular, in the secular world, it's the same way. Yeah. What's halachically? It's different. I'm sorry. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. What do you mean? What makes you suspicious? Do you want to speak into it? The question was about. I'm not sure I understand the question. The movement is to what? I'm not sure. For Baal Teshuva, you mean? And how is it used? How is religion used as a crutch in those examples? Oh, I see. As a way of, you're saying for somebody who's splitting, they might become even more stringent. I see. Right. I mean, I think it's hard to know. It's hard to be glib about that because I think it could mean different things for different situations. But I think I understand what you're saying. I mean, two different examples. In some situations, I think, you know, if somebody is splitting off, let's say, their behavior, their homosexual behaviors, right, and they're not integrating that into their identity, then you're saying that they in this example, they might be becoming more halachically machmir in other directions to kind of appease the other side. So, I mean, to the extent that their halachic stringency, to the extent that it's destructive, I mean, if it's just they're becoming more machmir because that somehow allows them to cope better, then because then to hey, you know, but if it becomes destructive, if they become, you know, aggressive about it in a way that's not okay, then it's a different question. I mean, if they become kind of, you know, if there's aggression and like angry towards others who are not as halakhically strict, then that's a maladaptive behavior, and that's a different story. But if it's their own way of coping, then, you know, I think people cope in different ways, right, with the shame and the guilt, right. I mean, but if there's nothing destructive about their halakhic stringency, then I wouldn't touch it. But right. I mean, this is somebody who's going towards orthodoxy, I see as a way of people. I hesitate to kind of make a rule because I think there are different situations and there are lots of factors to consider when you choose a therapist. You know, there's so many different factors. I mean, I think for me, I think my orthodoxy was very, very useful, and it was helpful, because also it allowed me to kind of negotiate with poskim, and to speak, and I spoke the language, so I understood. And when there were issues in the community or with their from relatives that were problematic, I was able to kind of, you know, be a part of that process. You know, on the other hand, some people, the opposite side though, might be true for some people that they might feel more comfortable with the anonymity of a non-religious therapist who is still respectful of Frumkeit. I think it's hard to say. And also, not everybody can find a Frum therapist in their area. But one thing that happened after the film, Stanley Dabowski, the director of the film, got wrote a grant to Steven Spielberg, and he got seed money for a conference that we ran a few years ago. We invited therapists from different cities to come to New York for a 3-day training on all these issues. And we had experts in the field of research on these questions, and we had gay people speak and give testimonies about what they went through in therapy, both good experiences and bad. And it was a very powerful conference. But the idea behind the conference was to cultivate leadership in this area among mental health professionals who could then be advocates for people in trouble, not advocates for gayness, but advocates for people who needed help in different cities. So we do have a network of people in different cities. If you know, I can talk to you about that after this. But I think it's complicated. I think I think a good therapist, like we talked about last night, I think there are lots of good secular therapists who'd be respectful. I think it's hard to say. I don't think there's a formula. Yeah. Well, anyone who comes to me is not looking for, they know I'm not a halakhic authority. People who want halakhic understanding would not be coming to me. They would be coming to a Rav. So people who come to me are looking for help with their lives. So, it's true that for many Orthodox people, the text of Vayikra looms large, and it's always paramount. In my experience, people have not come and said, "I need help with Vayikra." Generally, for the most part, people come in and they say, or if they did, I would say to them, "Well, what about that makes it? What's the hardest aspect of that? What about that is the hardest piece for you?" And it's always different for people. For some people, it'll be, I'm disappointing my parents. Then we can look at the relationship with their parents and what is that about. If for other people, it'll be I always wanted to have children. That's a different piece. Some people will say, I can't find a place for myself in the community, or I'm losing my friends, or I feel isolated. For everybody, it's different. As most of you know who've been involved in the work of therapy, for 100 people, it'll manifest differently in 100 different ways. So there are themes, but most people who are struggling with Vayikra don't come to me. They're Rebbeim that they talk to about that. But for them, what they're most interested in is how it affects their lives on a day-to-day basis. And in that way, that's where I would come in. Okay.